a better way. You don't have to think.
Well, hi folks, this is Jack Spirico with the Survival Podcast. Welcome to an episode of Friday Flashbacks. After 15 years and hundreds of interview shows, we decided to run them as flashbacks every Friday, beginning with the oldest of them and going forward. There's a tremendous library of wisdom in all the great interviews we've done over the years, so sit back and enjoy. Whether this is your first time or even your second time around with today's episode, I'm sure you will enjoy it and learn a lot from it. And remember, you can help support the Survival Podcast and the work we do just by becoming a member of the Survival Podcast Members Support Brigade. If you do that, you'll get access to over 70 awesome discount codes on products and services you likely already use. Things like seeds, cannabis products, food storage items, custom roasted coffee, and even cool stuff like ammo and moonshine stills and more. So support the show, get all your money back and more. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more and sign up. Now let's get into today's Friday Flashback. And we are flashing back today, folks, to January the 18th, 2011, originally episode 589. Chef Keith Snow on cooking from your preps and from the field. This was a great episode. It was also the first time that Chef Keith was on the Survival Podcast and became a long-term member of the community, and to this day he still pops up from time to time. So let's go ahead and flash back to January of 2011 and Chef Keith's first appearance on the Survival Podcast. And with that, as I was saying during the beginning of the housekeeping, we are fortunate today to have Chef Keith Snow with us today. Hey, Keith, thanks for joining us once again on the Survival Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jack. I definitely appreciate being on.
Well, cool. Hey, I know I've had you on a few times. We had you on for the Thanksgiving episode, which, by the way, we had tremendous feedback from that. We had you on once before to talk about cooking, you know, with healthy eating stuff from your backyard. But some of the folks may not have heard those episodes. So could you give us, you know, the 1 to 2 minute synopsis background? Who's Chef Keith Snow, and how'd you end up doing something a little bit different than, I guess, most of your restaurant what would you call them? Your brethren.
Cohorts.
Yeah, your cohorts. That's the word I was looking for. Colleagues. What are, you know, your colleagues are out there, right? And they're plating up stuff in these expensive restaurants. You used to do that, and now you kind of do the same type of thing I do, and you're out spreading the message about fresh eating. How'd that happen?
Yeah, well, it's a 25-year career, basically. Started cooking when I was really young, about 14 years old in New Jersey, and worked my way up the chain, so to speak, from dishwasher all the way up to executive chef of a big ski resort in the mountains of Colorado. And throughout all of those years, I studied finance and economics in college. I was an ice hockey player, and I cooked, you know, to keep beer in the fridge and money in the pocket, so to speak. I only really got serious about my career probably in the last 10 years or so. And what happened with us is when we were out in Colorado and I was executive chefing, we wound up having our first daughter. And it was so cold. We lived at 10,000 feet. I didn't want to raise her in that perpetual winter. So having grown up around farms, I come from the Northeast, and my family, we had dairy farms, and some of my uncles raised horses. So we had pretty agrarian lifestyle. And I wanted to raise my kids in a farming type of atmosphere. So I actually flew to North Carolina just near the Asheville area. I found a farm property. It was just, you know, vacant land. I bought it. We moved there in 2003. We built a barn, and then we started to get into gardening and grass-fed beef, and we had chickens and dairy goats. And this was at a time when everybody was interested in the whole low-carb stuff, but we went, my wife and I, just head forth into, you know, local cooking and seasonal cooking, and it really, it defined my my culinary style, because before that I was into all kinds of ethnic foods, and, you know, I've got some classic French training, but local foods and seasonal cooking was not all that popular, but that's really what I decided, you know, really fit for me, and one thing led to another, and I put up a website and started, you know, getting great response from people literally all over the world. We've got members in 140 countries, and started putting up my recipes. And then in 06, I started shooting culinary videos. I published my first cookbook with a company called Running Press as my publisher in 2009. It's called The Harvest Eating Cookbook. It's got about 200 recipes in it. You know, it's available everywhere. And, you know, this thing has really taken off, and the website Harvest Eating is just growing very fast. And like you mentioned, I'm a podcaster like you, and just focused on teaching people how to live a sustainable life, you know, using local and seasonal food. So that's the elevator speech, man.
Well, that's an excellent one, and that's why I've had you on the show in the past, while I'll have you on the show in the future, honestly, because there's a lot of folks out there that are getting into gardening, and they're cooking, or they're growing things that you don't buy generally in the grocery store. You don't see them there, or even now that they're starting to come in. We're going to talk about chard in a little bit, because I asked you about that, and you get some ideas for it. You know, people are seeing in the grocery store now, it's kind of taking off, but they don't know what the heck to do with it. And there's all of these things that people store. So the folks, the reason we have Keith on today is to talk about, you know, taking your gruel up a notch, let's say, you know, and actually enjoying it. So all the stuff that we store and all the stuff that we grow, we can actually enjoy it, and use it. And let's start out with wheat, because I know I've got preppers out there that have like buckets and buckets and buckets of hard wheat. And hopefully they've got a grinder too, and a grinder that'll grind and a grinder that will crack, because eating wheat berries out of a bucket break your teeth. But a lot of them, I think, have no idea what to do with that stuff. It's just there in case, you know. And actually, it's one of the great foods. I mean, you talked about low carb in the past, and grains have gotten a bad rap as of late. But to me, what should be getting a bad rap is bleached, nutrient-deficient white flour. Whole grains are a great source of nutrients and protein and carbohydrate, good carbs. So what should folks be doing with that big, massive pile of wheat other than waiting for Armageddon?
Yeah, those are great points, Jack, all of them that you made there. And, you know, one of the things that I see, you know, not just with wheat, but, you know, people are worried about what's going to happen with the economy, and definitely your audience, you know, preparing, saving food, making sure that if something does go wrong, they're going to be in a good position. But I think one of the critical mistakes is for people to, like you said, store buckets of grain or have bags of dehydrated vegetables or frozen this or that and not know how to cook with it. To me, one of the things that I'm really trying to do with my audience is make sure that people are becoming proficient cooks and using these things, because, you know, God forbid something happens, you don't want to all of a sudden be in a position where you don't know what to do with these things. And you mentioned wheat. A lot of people don't even know what a wheat berry is. So your audience is probably a lot smarter than the average people, and they've got these wheat berries in storage. And the reason that they're whole like that is because once you grind wheat or just about any grain, it's really going to go bad quick. So They're generally stored in, 5-gallon buckets with Mylar. As a matter of fact, I just got a 5-gallon bucket just the other day. And there's a lot of things that can be done with wheat. And for sure, what I'd like to see people do is become proficient at using it. And a couple of ideas, like you mentioned, you definitely need a grinder, because if you try to take those wheat berries and, you know, put them in a coffee grinder, you're not really going to get a complete grind. You're going to have some, you know, flour or powdery mixture, but then you're going to have a lot of cracked grains, which are going to give you kind of a weird texture. But I would definitely invest in a grinder, but there's a lot of things that can be done with wheat. And first of all, I want to start out with some cereals. Now, you can take whole wheat berries. You don't even need to grind it. And you can take your wheat berries and you can cook them and make a cereal out of them, like a hot cereal. They take a while to cook. And these things, this isn't 10 minutes. They're going to take, you know, 35, 45 minutes, something like that, to become tender. But what I like to do is to take, let's say you take a couple of cups, and we'll provide the listeners some recipes to use, but let's say you take a couple of cups of these wheat berries. You can put them in a pot, and this is where you definitely want a tight-fitting lid. And you can make a mixture of water, and I like to use whole milk, with a teeny bit of sugar, and you cook these things down, and this is a great thing to do as far as being prepared for breakfast. You can make a whole pot of these wheat berries. And once they're cooked down, they're going to release quite a bit gelatinous material. They want to thicken up, sort of like oats. If you cook oats, you'll kind of find they get a little gluey.
Is that the gluten that you're seeing come out when you do that?
Right. That's the gluten, and it tends to thicken it up a bit. But making these hot cereals like that, once you have it cooked, as far as storing it, you can take it and portion it up into things that can be frozen, whether it be plastic bags or little Ziploc freezable containers. You can store it for later, but just having it for breakfast is incredible. What I like to do is, you mentioned that it's whole grain. It's got a load of nutrition in it because the grain is intact, the bran, the endosperm, really all of the nutrition is in the part that's usually removed. And, you know, people use a lot of, like you mentioned, just white flour. Most of the nutrition is taken out of that. But these wheat berries, they are an unbelievable energy source. And what I like to do is, once I have them cooked down, and we like to pre-cook a whole pot of them, then we keep it in the refrigerator, you can take it out, and let's just say you've got them cold or already cooked. You take them out, and you put them into a sauce pot, put a half a cup of milk, bring it up to a boil to reheat it, and then you put it in a bowl. I like to put a dollop of full-fat Greek yogurt and like a teaspoon of maple syrup on there, and you've got just an unbelievable breakfast. And people that haven't tried wheat berries, they same thing with steel-cut oats. They have a really nutty flavor. It's very, very flavorful. It's got a great texture. And, you know, right now, obviously, we're in the middle of the winter. I couldn't think of a better food for breakfast, because not only is it warm, it's filling, but it does have a lot of sustained energy. And you had mentioned, you know, the carbohydrates and all there. When you eat that, it's going to fuel you for a good long time, because you've got the bran and the endosperm. All of that nutrition in the whole grain is going to keep you going for hours. It's not going to be that, you know, if you have like a bowl of cornflakes or something, you're going to get that quick little burst, but in 40 minutes, you're going to feel hungry. You're going to have kind of a caffeine crash, so to speak. But when you eat these wheat berries like that, these hot cereals, you can have a nice, long, sustained, full feeling, and they're just so nutritious. And that's definitely one way to cook with them. Have you ever done that yourself?
Absolutely, and I was going to point a couple things out. One, the reason you get that sustained energy there is because it's what nutritionist and well-known author Tim Ferriss would call a slow carb. So the carbohydrate is there. If there's a certain number of grams of carbohydrate there, or a certain number of grams of carbohydrate in a cornflake, the same number of carbs are there. It's the body has to do work to access it. So it's almost like taking a time-released capsule versus a pill that just dissolves and goes in your system instantly. You get that sustainment over time, and that way you don't get peaks in your blood sugar. So you're not going to get real fat eating this. I mean, people have gotten this carb thing on their mind where if I eat carbs, I'm going to get fat. And if you go look at the places where people live on grains like this, there are not a lot of fat people running around. The other thing I wanted to point out to folks while we're listening here, a great place to go and get a small amount of this to try these things with before you buy a 50-pound sack or get your 50-pound sack shipped to you is Honeyville Grains. And for those in the brigade, you guys get a discount there of 10%, so make sure you get your discount. But I'm going to have Keith keep going on here and tell you some other things you can do with wheat. But if you're not sure on something and you're not sure you're going to like it, you know, go out and get a couple pounds of it in a can and try these recipes, figure out how much of it you're going to actually use, and then stock up based on, and that's why we have Keith on today, to give you these ways to actually use this stuff. So you want to give them some other things they can do with it? And, I mean, what you're talking about is great. Another thing I've done real quick is, if I want to make a little bit of like what you're talking about and I don't want to sit there on the stove with it, I'll take like a real thick insulated thermos bottle, throw some wheat in there, boil some water, dump that in the thermos bottle, put the lid on it, and let it sit overnight. And you wake up in the morning and it's perfectly cooked. And
that's a great idea.
But I've never tried like what you're saying, like throw some yogurt and some maple syrup on there. That kind of to take it up a notch. Sometimes I throw fruit on there. But the thing that made me think of too is, we got a lot of beekeepers. I'm sure that honey would just go awesome with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Honey on top of Greek yogurt is a very classic combination. But like you were getting into the fruits, you know, putting. Think seasonal. Like the wheat is a staple. You'll have it year round, but, you know, if you're in the summer, you could put things like peaches on there. If you're in the middle of the winter, I like to put prunes and raisins and pears, things like that. But another thing that you can do with that, I'll switch gears from a hot breakfast. I'm going to stay with the theme of using the whole wheat berry. And your point of the sustained energy release is really critical because, like you said, it doesn't give you that huge spike in your blood sugar. So it's perfect for, you know, maintaining your health. But I like to also cook these things and then use them to make a salad. Now, you can think very Mediterranean, but making a wheat berry salad is something that's just awesome. Let's say you've got, I don't know, 2-3 cups of these cooked wheat berries. Now, these you would want to cook just with water. You wouldn't want to cook them in milk. But let's say you've got them cooked and you put a little bit of salt in these. So they're cooked down, they're soft. Now you can toss like a French mustard vinaigrette and toss some vinaigrette in there, and you can put in all types of vegetables, a little bit of minced onion, some garlic, some fresh mint, and then you can put shredded carrots in there. You can dice up fruit like cubed cantaloupe and melons, things like that. You can put in leeks that have been sautéed ahead of time, and you make this wheat berry salad. And I'm pretty sure I've got a recipe for it on my website, Harvest Eating, but if not, I'll make sure that your listeners get one. But now you're talking about an unbelievable sort of like a spa dish. It's going to be low in fat, really nutritious, filling, and have great flavor. And what's even more important to me is the texture. People don't pay a big, they don't pay enough mind to texture in cooking. And these wheat berries, they've got incredible texture. And when you put that French mustard vinaigrette and then all of these other things like onions and garlic and maybe some sauteed leeks and a little fruit and some fresh herbs in there, you've got an incredible meal. And it's great for a picnic. It could be made ahead of time. You can take it out for a picnic lunch. You can also use it as a bed to put, let's say, a piece of steamed fish over it or a piece of grilled chicken or, heck, even a steak. So make like a berry salad is an awesome thing to do. And you can also do the same thing with lentils. I'll throw that in there. Like whole lentils cooked and tossed in a mustard vinaigrette is a great thing. But let's also switch gears from the wheat berries to wheat itself. You can grind the wheat, like take your grinder and grind it. And then you can make, everyone knows about cream of wheat or farina. And it's just another way to make a hot cereal. And I would do the same thing. I would heat up a little bit of milk and water, bring it up to a boil, and definitely put a pinch of salt in there. Now, people may think that salt would be weird in sort of a sweet breakfast cereal, but just a pinch of kosher salt is going to bring out all of the underlying flavors. And that's one thing that salt does, is it makes your tongue able to taste more things. So put a pinch of salt in there and cook the ground wheat. And once that water and milk comes up to a boil, you put a little salt in there. You can put some sugar, then you put the wheat in there and you just stir it. It's going to slowly absorb up all of the liquid and you're going to have like a whole wheat cereal. And again, you can dress that with anything. You can put raisins on it. You could put a little bit, I like to just take heavy whipping cream once it's cooked and just pour a little bit of whipping cream over the top, maybe a sliced banana, and now you've got a really great hot cereal. So those are a few things that you can do with the wheat. And also, I definitely would encourage people to take their preps of wheat berries, learn how to grind it, and learn how to make breads and muffins, pastries, things like that, because making bread is a critical thing to do with wheat berries. And I just actually shot a video the other day, Jack. I'm going to be posting it, and I'll make sure your listeners have access to it. And it shows a very simple whole wheat bread. Now, this one does have some bread flour in it, which is not a whole grain, but it also has whole wheat. It's about 33% whole wheat. And you can make bread that's just killer if you use, freshly cracked whole wheat. And that's another thing.
So what you're doing there, just so I get this, because I think this is pretty much what I do, you're doing about a third of it from fresh ground. And then you do two-thirds of your typical white bread flour. And that lightens it, but it also lets you use your wheat, and it brings that nuttiness and all in there, because pure whole wheat bread can be kind of heavy. So you're bringing the white flour in to lighten it, but you're keeping, and instead of just using off the shelf ground 6 months ago wheat flour, you're bringing that fresh ground wheat in with the off the shelf white flour.
Right. That's exactly right. And like you said, it can be, you know, if you use all whole, all the wheat, you can make a hockey puck, but I've also found that the majority of that sort of hockey puck or heavy texture that you get with whole wheat is happening because the wheat is old. And I've tested this before where we did an episode of our TV show, and it was based on whole grains, and we featured a company, I'm going to point this out to your listeners, called Anson Mills, and it's A-N-S-O-N, Anson Mills. They're in Columbia, South Carolina. And the guy that runs this operation, his name is Glenn Roberts. And he is, he's like part historian. He's a seedsman. I mean, this is one of the most interesting guys I've ever met. And he has people all over the country growing different grains from them. And they're all heirloom crops. And when we interviewed him, he sent me home with a bag, a 5 pound bag of what's called Red Fife. And it's a type of, heritage, wheat. And he ground it right there in front of me, and I took that wheat home, and I was testing bread recipes with it, and side by side, I would use whole wheat that came in the 5 pound bags from the store. And the difference, Jack, I mean, I'm telling you, night and day. The stuff in the store would produce that dense, sort of hockey puck, terrible bread, where the freshly ground wheat from this guy, or even stuff that you do yourself, would rise up very predictably and make a beautiful loaf. So a lot of it has to do with the wheat just kind of being old. So
yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with using pre-ground, because the wheat has a tremendous shelf life. But when you, it's like coffee. You can go buy roasted coffee, and if you grind it yourself, you get a much richer aroma, a much richer flavor. If you buy wheat and grind it yourself, I think you'll find that. Then I don't know if you've tried this, but one of the things I've done with any time I'm making bread is running the flour through a sifter. And even sometimes I've double sifted it. It seems, and I don't do a lot of the kneading and yeast breads. I do like beer breads and Irish soda bread. And I get a lot, if you do sift the flour and make one and don't sift the flour and make the other, you see a big difference there as well.
Yeah, no, it definitely helps to lighten it up. But, yeah, whole grains are really awesome. And I like, using those wheat berries. And, you know, I gotta tell you, like, the wheat berry salad is just awesome. I mean, if somebody would try that, it's such a refreshing dish. It's loaded with texture and flavor. Just a great way to use those wheat berries. And, you know, people need to know how to cook with these things, because you definitely don't want to have to cook with them and then be figuring it out. But perfecting bread is definitely key, and I do a lot of bread, and this video that I'll post will show people how to do it's any kneading. It's kind of like a no-knead bread, and I bake it right in a heavy cast iron pot in the oven, and it's great for toast. It's got that really dark crust, and you know, the whole nooks and crannies thing with the melted butter lodged in there. Just incredible. I mean, I actually had it this morning with a fried egg. But, yeah, wheat berries are versatile, and, you know, you can't say enough about the nutrition.
Awesome. Well, let's kind of keep the ball rolling here, and let's talk about chard. I've recommended that everybody grow Swiss chard, and everything from you eating it to if you grow backyard rabbits, having it for rabbit food, because once you get it established, it's a biannual, and if you can overwinter it, I mean, it just keeps coming back, and you can keep adding plants every year, and you can basically have a patch of chard going forever. It's hardy, it handles winter, it handles summer, I mean, it comes in all these great colors. You can even plant it in your plant. It looks good in a, you know, mixed in with a flower bed, because you've got the golden varieties, the ruby varieties, but a lot of people have said to me, Jack, what do you do with it? And I do a variety of things with it, but I knew you could come up with something maybe unique. So what can the folks that are growing all that chard I've been telling them to grow do with chard?
Well, what I love about chard, like you said, is it's definitely easy to grow and it can take the cold weather. There's a load of varieties of chard. I mean, you mentioned a couple, but there's tons of varieties. But chard is really versatile. And, you know, like the wheat berries, these type of vegetables, they are loaded with nutrition. I mean, chard and things like kale and collards, I mean, they've got all kinds of calcium and vitamin A. They're very healthy for you. But what I like to do with chard is I love to saute it. And if you take chard, and what you'll want to do is, you don't want to take out all of the stalk. I mean, people, sometimes they take their chard and they just remove the entire stem, and then they just use the kind of wilty leaves. And that's fine, but you can eat those stems. They take a little longer to cook. Just slice them up fine. But I like to keep some of the stem there. And a great dish to make is, think about garlic, onions, and bacon. I mean, everyone listening is probably going to have, you know, their mouth watering. But if you take a pot and you put in some extra virgin olive oil and a touch of butter, and then a couple of slices of bacon, right? And you want a little of that fat in there to help the bacon start to render out. But fry the bacon up, and once it starts to get golden brown, throw in your Swiss chard, and you'll just basically chop it up. It doesn't need to be anything, you know, fancy with the cut, but slice it up and put the chard in there and turn the pan up pretty high and let it saute pretty hard. And you'll want to add salt and pepper, but you've got olive oil, butter, bacon, minced garlic, minced onion, you've got your chard, you want to put some salt and pepper. If you like spicy, you can definitely put a little red pepper flake in there. But let that saute for a few minutes, and then what I like to do is put a little bit of chicken stock in it, cover it, and turn the heat down, and let that simmer for a little bit until it gets tender. There is no better side dish than that sauteed chard like that. And again, think of it as a bed on your plate for a nice steak or maybe a piece of roasted chicken or even some wild game or fish. That is one incredible way to cook chard, and you can do the same thing with kale. You can do the same thing with collard greens. Another thing I like to do, Jack, with that recipe is once I've got the chard cooked down, and when you do these things, you got to remember, while it looks like it's a lot, it cooks way down. So people need to be prepared that make a lot more than you think you're going to eat, because once you cook it, it's really going to shrink down. But I like to cook a bunch of it in that same manner. The bacon's optional. You don't have to use the bacon. But once you've got a bunch of it cooked down, what you can do is make little souffles out of it. And what you want to do is you're going to take a bowl and you're going to whisk in eggs. Try to get eggs that come from your neighbors, because these eggs anymore in the store, I mean, these things are a joke. And I've done videos before where you compare a real egg next to a store egg. I mean, it's night and day difference.
I wanted to point this out. If you are growing chickens for eggs and you have anywhere near the space for it, what you've got to do, folks, is plant a mulberry. If you look at eggs from chickens at the time of the season when they're eating the mulberries, the yolks are almost red. And I don't know what it does, but it is the richest, most amazing organic egg you will ever eat, a chicken that's been feeding on mulberries. And they love them. And the damn trees produce so many, you can feed your chickens for about 2 months with mulberries falling off the trees. And I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but that's one of them things, if I don't say it, I'll forget.
No, that's a good point. I mean, it's the same thing with you and I. I mean, you are what you eat. And you can see the difference between a chicken that's locked up and fed cheap corn and just lousy grain to one that's allowed to go out. Chickens are omnivores, so they eat all kinds of stuff. And getting those rich yolks is going to make your souffle that much better. But continuing on, let's just say, and I'm going to give you guys a recipe for this, so don't take out your pencils, but just think in your mind. You take, you know, let's 6 or 8 of these beautiful egg yolks. Separate out the whites. Just use the yolks. Whisk these things up. And then what you can do is take your cooked chard and mix it in there, and then put in a good cheese. And I would recommend something like Gruyere, which is a raw milk Swiss cheese. If you didn't have that, you could use something simple like sharp cheddar. But make that mixture and put a little bit of Parmesan cheese in there. And once you take that, put it into greased ramekins or small. You could do it in one big, like an enamel cast iron dish as well if you didn't have ramekins. But I like to cook it in a serving size ramekin, something that you would see like creme brulee come out in, and make 6 or 8 of those, and then you want to cook it in a water bath. And that's called a bain-marie. And what it basically is taking those custard cups or ramekins, you put them inside of another container and put a little bit of boiling water in there, and then bake these off in a slower oven, about a 300-degree oven. and in about 25 or 30 minutes, they're going to set up, and because you've got those egg yolks in there, they're going to want to raise up a little bit. It's not going to souffle like a great one, but it'll rise up a little bit. And the combination of that slightly bitter chard, those rich eggs, and some, you know, sharp cheese like that, I mean, it's just unbelievable. And I make that stuff all the time with, and I serve it as a side dish with other things, but chard in a souffle like that's incredible. And you can also use it in a stuffing, like cook it down like I just mentioned, and let's say you take a chicken breast and you make a pocket in there, you can mix some cheese in there, a little bit of breadcrumbs, and stuff it inside of a pork loin or a chicken breast and then roast it off. Just incredible. I mean, this stuff
you
is
mentioned
so
a
versatile.
Soup when you sent me an email about chard. You mentioned a soup. What do you got in mind with that? Because I think it might be a clone of like one of my favorite restaurant soups from what is it, Olive Garden?
Yeah, no, that's I was just about to go there. Yeah, you think about I would do. Let's say you go to the store and you buy a chicken and buy the whole chicken, because when you buy, a lot of people just buy chicken breasts, you get ripped off. Buy the whole chicken, take that chicken. Rinse it off, make sure there's nothing hidden in that pocket, no yuckies inside the carcass. Take it all out, rinse it off, and put it in a big stock pot, and then fill it up. And this is key, you want to fill it up with cold water, not hot water. Fill it up with cold water and put some vegetables in there. Some, if you have leeks, cleaned leeks are great, an onion, a carrot, a little bit of celery, a few peppercorns and a bay leaf. And then slowly let the thing come up to a simmer. And what you definitely don't want to do, you don't want to boil it. Let it come up to a simmer and watch it. Because if it's boiling, you're going to have a cloudy kind of nasty stock. But let it simmer with the lid on for about an hour. And then you can take the chicken out, and you can use the chicken itself for anything. You can make chicken salad. You can make burritos with chicken, all kinds of things. But the point is you've got a rich homemade chicken stock. And just so your listeners know, the difference between a broth and a stock is the use of bones. If you just used meat, if you just used chicken breast and there was no bones, you would have what would be called broth. When you have the bones in there, now you've got stock. And what's great about the stock is there's gelatin and bones. And when you cook that chicken for a good hour, you simmer it really slowly like that, the gelatin, which is very healthy for your body, is going to get into that stock. So now once you've got that stock, then you'll set that aside, and then you'll take a pot, and you're going to saute onions and garlic with a little bit of carrot and celery. And once you get a little bit of color on that, just start to color, throw in a bunch of raw chard that you've sliced up and washed, and definitely be careful with chard because it grows, you know, in sandy soil. It's got a lot of places where dirt likes to hide. You want to give it a nice, careful rinse in cold water. Anyway, you put your, put a bunch, like a lot, and really fill the pot up with this sliced up chard. Let it saute for a little bit, and then cover it up with the chicken stock you just made. Make sure you're seasoning this with a little bit of salt and pepper, and then take 2 to 3 russet potatoes. Don't use any other kind. Don't use red skinned or Yukon gold. You want the russet potatoes because they've got a lot of starch. Peel them and put them in. You only need to halve them. Put them in halved. Let's say you have, let's say 4 potatoes. You cut them in half. There's 8 pieces. You've got the broth, the aromatics, and the chard. Put a cover on that. Let it come up to a boil, then turn it down to a simmer and let that cook for about an hour. And when you're done cooking it, take the lid off and take your potato masher and go in there and just press down and mash the potatoes. You don't want them, you know, totally mashed. You just want to break them up, and they're going to break up because they've cooked for a while. And then, Jack, you serve that, and you can put a little bit of Parmesan cheese on that, or you can float some extra virgin olive oil in it. Let's say you put a big bowl of it. Just take your really incredible extra virgin olive oil and put a little drizzle of that over top with a little pinch of good Parmesan cheese, and you have an unbelievable dish. That chard with its slight bitterness and all that nutrition, it's really deep and green. You got the homemade chicken stock, the potatoes that are kind of that they're broken up because you didn't dice them, you didn't cut them perfectly. You let them just kind of get soft, and you hit them with a masher. They're going to have all that gorgeous irregular texture. You've got some aromatics in there. It's unbelievable. You want to talk about a good warming soup, a chard and potato soup like that with stock that you make, it can't be beat.
You see, every time I bring you on this show, halfway through the show, you're just killing me. And I wonder what I'm going to cook today. Seriously, I mean, you're the only guy I know I can bring on to talk about wheat and talk about making wheat cereal and to make me hungry. And that's awesome. And that's what I'm saying is, folks, if we get creative with this stuff. And the other thing is, you guys are always asking me, how do I share prepping? How do I get people on board with what we're doing? Well, if you bring them over to your house, you serve them that. It's going to lead to the question, how the hell did you figure this out? And, well, I grew that out in my yard, and maybe even you grew your potatoes or you got them from the local market or whatever. And when you start having conversations about how to put together meals and you start talking about the components, it leads you into, well, you know, we grow a garden. This is part of – and also what would be an uncomfortable spreading of the message becomes very comfortable because food is the most social – The best social lubricant I know of. If we can get people eating together, we can have all kinds of great conversations. And I'd love to have some conversations over a bowl of that soup. Let's move on, though, because I got a lot of stuff here I wanted to talk to you about today. I also have a lot of folks out there that I've kind of encouraged, get out there, get that 22 or that 20 gauge or that 12 gauge. Learn how to hunt. Go out there and feed yourself. And I don't think, there's a lot of things you can hunt in some areas but not others, like pheasants. There's limited places you can hunt for pheasants and all, but just about anywhere in the United States, people that are going to go out there and small game hunt, which is a great entry into the sport, are going to have access to either squirrels or rabbits or something damn close. You know, it might be something, maybe it's a marmot, but whatever you can do with a squirrel, you can do with a marmot, folks. It might sound a little weird, but the small animals in this common genre, they all have very similar flavor profiles. So I've got a guy out there with a mess of squirrels or a mess of cottontails. Keith, what are some ideas you have for that?
Well, coming from the South, we've got a famous dish down here called Brunswick stew. And it's kind of funny, but it's one of those recipes that people, you know, it comes down through the family, and they put their own spin on it. But basically, a Brunswick stew is like a tomato-based stew. It has different things in it, whether it be butter beans or you could even put lentils in it. But it's basically like a tomato-based stew, and oftentimes you're going to see it made with squirrel meat or rabbit. Sometimes people put pork and beef in it, but it's definitely best with squirrel. And, you know, like you said, I mean, squirrels are everywhere. And those little things taste incredible in a Brunswick stew. Their meat has a pretty good richness to it. And this is an easy-to-make stew. And you can find, you know, we'll link up a recipe, but there's tons of different methods to make it. But it's just like any other stew. It needs a long cooking time to get everything tender. But it needs also to be highly seasoned, and it's, you know, with a tomato base, you can use different stocks for this. You could use chicken stock. You could even make squirrel stock with the bones. Just depends how creative you want to get there. But people definitely around here, particularly in like northern Georgia, western North Carolina, the upstate of South Carolina, Brunswick stew has got a long and storied tradition. I actually worked for a chef at the Biltmore Estate years ago. And this gentleman, I think he was from Georgia, and he was a huge fan of Brunswick stew, and I remember him making it, and boy, it's so good. Have you ever tried it?
Yeah, squirrel stew is huge with me. I've been making different variations thereof for as long as I've been old enough to put squirrels in the pot. In fact, probably before I was doing it myself, my dad and his brother would go out and you know, small game hunt, and they mostly hunted for grouse and pheasants, and they would shoot squirrels and rabbits as they came across them and bring them home and clean them, but they were just kind of like they'd throw them in the freezer and, you know, maybe throw them in a browning bag and throw them in the oven. And I'd always heard about this stew, so I kind of took my stew recipe from like the way my grandmother would do it with beef, and she wasn't about cooking up rodents, so I just watched what she did, and I would cook rabbit and squirrel the same way. And one of the big traditions in kind of the northeastern woods I don't think we really called it Brunswick stew up there. It was very similar. is we would take a rabbit and three squirrels maybe, and we would make a combination of those, and it was kind of, you know, whatever you happen to have. If you had a bunch of rabbits, you'd do it with rabbit. If you had a bunch of squirrels, you do it with squirrels. But if you had both, you'd do a mix. And there is a difference in the meat. I think it's the person that eats it often that would be able to tell you the difference when it's in pieces off the bone floating in the stew. But the rabbit has a lighter, closer to, they say it tastes just like chicken, it doesn't, but closer to chicken. And the squirrel has maybe, I don't want to say gamey because that gives people the wrong idea, a richer, darker taste. I guess rabbit's more akin to white meat chicken and squirrel's more akin to dark meat chicken, I guess. But
yeah, that's how I would say it. It's kind of like it has a sort of like the chicken thigh sort of thing going on. I think chicken thighs are way better than breasts.
I agree. I always like the darker meat. The other thing I've done with squirrel and rabbit both, and rabbit you can get away with just straight doing it if it's a young rabbit, but an older rabbit or a squirrel, what you really want to do is if you have a good old-fashioned pressure cook them for about 15 minutes to tenderize them some, and then roll them in whatever you would fry chicken in, whatever your fried chicken recipe might be, and fry them till they float, just like you do a piece of chicken. And you want to, with squirrel and rabbit, it's a big animal. So obviously you want to, you know, especially rabbits, you want to quarter it up into, you know, individual size pieces. But that's a real simple, and I mean, I fed it to people that, like, the only reason they knew it was squirrel is because you got this little weird shaped leg, you know, instead of a drumstick. But if you can get people to give it a shot, generally, I haven't met anybody that would like a piece of fried chicken that wouldn't like a piece of fried squirrel or fried rabbit.
No, I agree. And it is, you got to think about, people don't understand, we mentioned earlier about you are what you eat, but nowadays, any kind of meat, when it gets commercialized and big business takes it and, you know, locks it up and starts feeding it things that it generally was not supposed to eat in nature, you know, the meat tastes different. But a squirrel, I mean, look what it's eating. I mean, it's eating all kinds of nuts and grasses, just things that are loaded with nutrition to start with. So the meat has got a lot of richness. It's got a lot of protein in it. And it's just loaded with flavor. I mean, it's a great stew. And like you mentioned, it's got that slight gaminess, but that's a good thing in my opinion.
Definitely. And I mean, I'll put it to you this way. I don't know the name of it. I guarantee you do, but there is a type of ham. I think it's Spanish. The hogs are these black hogs, and they're fed on acorns. And it's very expensive. Yeah. I can't remember
Serrano. It's called Serrano ham.
It's extremely expensive. Like, you buy, you know, the people in Spain, they go into these, like, we have, like, a beef jerky shop. They have, like, a ham shop. And they go in and they buy a piece of ham, cut off the ham, for a snack. And it's, like, you know, American equivalent of, like, $19 a pound for this ham from a street vendor who's slicing one small piece off and handing it to you. And the thing that makes that ham so amazing, a big part of it, is that huge diet of acorns. Well, you shoot a squirrel in October, November, December, January, it's an acorn-fed animal. And it's not the same thing, but there is something about animals feeding on acorns that makes the flavor of the meat better. I was talking about this recently, I think, on the show, where I grew up in a place where we had really two kind of areas we would hunt. We had farmlands and we had woodlands. And if you hunted, even like venison, out in the woodlands, where the animals were browse-fed and acorn-fed, compared to the one, they're not being like fed like they do down here in the South with a deer feeder, but they're raiding the farmer's field and eating the shell corn. The animals from the farmlands had a lot of fat. The squirrels, the rabbits, deer, all of them, more fat on them. And it's not the intermuscular fat like beef. You'd skin them, and they'd have huge fat reserves kind of floating outside the muscle, between the skin and the muscle. Up on the mountains, the animals were less fatty, but it wasn't the fat to me that was the difference. It was the diet itself. And you could literally take two identically sliced pieces of venison side by side and look at the acorn-fed animal and look at the animal that's living on the farmlands and getting a large portion of its diet from corn and soy and other things it was raiding from a field. And you could see a difference in the texture and the color of the flesh. The stuff from the mountains was a darker red, a denser texture. And it came through when you cooked it, especially you got to be careful with game. You know this because you're a classically trained chef and all. I know this because I'm a country boy that eats this stuff. You can't overcook it. You can't get paranoid with game and think because it's game, it's less clean and it needs to be cooked until it's gray. And that's, I think, a lot of people that have eaten venison or any kind of game and said, I really didn't care for it. It's because the person that cooked it was freaked out about it being game and murdered it with heat. And your comment about the difference in the quality of the meat, I feel much safer eating squirrel or deer off a mountaintop than I do a chicken from a processing plant, where people, you generally see that directly the opposite, but I guarantee you folks, if you took one trip inside a chicken house, you'd probably
never eat it again.
Unless you ate organic free range chicken, you'd never even pick up a piece of chicken again. It's horrific. It's disgusting. And then people turn around and they look at it and they go, I'm not eating a squirrel. And I'm looking at about six of them hanging off my feeder right now. And you're making me hungry. I might gamble a couple of these guys as soon as we're done with this episode. But great stuff there. What about fishing, man? We were talking about trout and stuff like that. You got a trout stream near you, so I'm sure you're doing some fish cooking. What do you got there?
Yeah, and again, the same theory of the feeding of the fish. I do not eat farm-raised fish because they're fed for profit, and they're fed for certain look and appearance, where a fish that's in the river is going to eat what it's supposed to eat. Yeah, we live on a year-round pretty good trout stream called the Mills River, North Mills River. It comes right out of Pisgah National Forest, and I can see the river actually right now. I look out my I'm in my bedroom at the moment, and the river is literally about 50 yards away, and it's loaded with trout. And there's browns, there's rainbows, and I love to fish for trout, and you can catch tons of them. I mean, you could catch in this river and all the rivers up here in the Blue Ridge Mountains, I mean, you could catch 20 trout in an afternoon pretty easily. Now, a lot of people catch and release them, which is great, but there's so many things you can do with trout, and there's so many great recipes for trout, and the same thing with bass and, you know, crappie, whatever you can catch, there's a way to cook it. And of course, these aren't salmon. You know, you're not going to get a trout that's, you know, where one side of it is 4 pounds or something. It's a lot less flesh, but it's delicious. And, you know, trout can be done, I mean, there's hundreds of ways, but one of the things I love to do with trout is I love smoking, and probably a lot of your listeners are into barbecue and all that. I've got a number of different smokers, and what I'll do is go out and go fishing and try to catch a good bit. You know, let's say you and your friends go out and you can get 25 trout. Take the trout, you know, take the heads off, scale them, gut them, leave the tails on, and then butterfly them open. And I like to slow smoke them. And I like using a combination of apple and oak. And down here in the Blue Ridge, we've got loads of oak. And here in Western North Carolina, there's quite a bit of apple trees. Here on my property, I think we've got 5 or 6 apple trees. Some of them are dead and need to be replaced, but I always harvest the wood. We cut one down in the fall, and I take that wood, and I set it aside because it's incredible to smoke on. So you take those trout, and we've got, if I can plug, we've got a new product that's coming out, Harvest Eating. It's called Low and Slow Competition Barbecue Rub. And it's a combination of organic spices that I've put together. And you take this, and let's just say you take your trout, and you just rub some of this this herb and spice mixture on it, and then smoke it over oak. I like white oak and apple. And it doesn't take very long to smoke trout because it doesn't have much weight to it. But if you smoke those trout, and then you let them cool off and peel the meat off, you can do a number of things. You can make trout tacos, smoked trout tacos, smoked trout burritos. There is nothing better than smoked trout pate. And what I'll do is I'll take a bunch of that smoked trout, and then I'll take heavy cream. And again, I like to use cream that comes from grass-fed animals. We buy only raw milk, and it comes from Jersey cows. And you take that cream, you put it in a pot with some garlic, and I would like to use something like tarragon. Put in a sprig of tarragon, a little bit of garlic, and maybe a touch of minced onion. And let that, with some salt and pepper, let that cream heat up. You got to watch it. You can't go off and check your email because it can catch fire. But let it come to a scald, and then turn the heat way down and just let it scald for about 15 or 20 minutes. And what you're doing is creating an emulsion. And you also want to let it reduce. You want to get as much of the moisture out and cook it until it starts to thicken up a bit. And then you pour that mixture through a strainer, and then you want to cool it off, right? And once it's cool, take your trout, put in a food processor, and whiz it up a little bit. You want to put in that cold cream. And you got to put it in a little bit at a time, because if you dump the whole thing in, you might have too much. So put in a tablespoon at a time and let the food processor whiz it up. If you don't have a food processor, you can certainly do it with a potato masher or something like that, or even with a knife if you're pretty industrious. But make a mousse out of it. And what happens is it's got that smoke from the wood that you did, and then the cream was infused with the aromatics and the herbs. And you don't have to use tarragon if you don't like it. You could use thyme or even basil. But you make that smoked trout mousse, Jack, I got to tell you, there is nothing better. You have your friends over. You talked about being social and, you know, getting people interested in being more sustainable. Have people come over for a little dinner party, and you can take that wheat we talked about. You can make some gorgeous crackers out of it, or heck, you can buy some crackers, and you serve people some smoked trout pate or mousse, whatever you want to call it, and it's got that richness, that smoke flavor, and then you tell them that they came out of the local stream and you did it all yourself. I mean, you're a rock star, and the food is incredible. I mean, it's so easy to make that. You can use all different types of trout. You can even use salmon if you're able to catch them. I mean, some people that are listening are probably in areas where they can fish for salmon.
Salmon, lake trout, things like that. And then for us down here in the South, because we do have some trout down here, but it's like for 2 months when it's like cold, and then they're like little bitty ones, and then they die as soon as it warms up in April. Everything that Keith said about trout with smoking them, some fish don't smoke well, but catfish, you got to skin them, unlike the trout where you leave maybe the skin on. But catfish smoked, you can do all of that with it, and catfish smokes. It's one of the best fish for smoking there is, in my opinion, because it's got enough fat in it to handle the smoking without drying out. So that sounds awesome. One thing I've done, you can do this with trout, you can do this with any fish. We fish a lot around here for a fish called white bass. I know they've got them up your way, but we've got them down here where literally if with a stick of dynamite, you can probably catch 1,000 in 15 seconds with a rock and a piece of tape. I mean, they're just swarming our lakes. And they're a fatty fish with a different kind of fat. They do not smoke well. They're great for frying. Same with striped bass. But one of the things we've done with them, we just have a few, and we don't want to really, you know, batter them up and all. You just take them and fillet them. And then you use either olive oil or butter and brush the one side with them. And you know, a little bit of herb, salt, pepper, whatever you want in there. I usually do like basil, salt, pepper, and a sprinkle of paprika. And just throw it straight. Well, you got to leave the skin on to do this. Throw those fillets straight on the grill. Good hot grill. Never cover it because you'll overcook it. And just cook it till the skin crisps up, almost like a little bowl you're going to eat the flesh out of. And just I mean, that as simple as it is, you know, and that can be done on a campfire.
Yeah, no, that you mentioned the striped bass here in the upstate of South Carolina. There's a lake called Lake Hartwell and Lake Jocassee, and they're loaded with those striped bass. And that's a versatile fish. I like the ideas you were mentioning. We love to fry it. I mean, there is fried fish is awesome, and striped bass is so good fried. And we used to, up on Cape Cod, my brothers have a boat up there, and in the summer we go up there, and there's a short window where you can catch striped bass. But those things are so good. The only problem with it is if you're not there in time, you wind up catching nothing but bluefish.
Yeah.
But bluefish lend themselves really well to the recipe I just described. Smoked bluefish are awesome. But, taking striped bass, what we used to do is we would catch these things, we would fillet them right there on the beach, and we would go right home and make striped bass sandwiches. And we basically just make a light beer batter with a little tonic water and a little bit of beer and some either rice flour or all-purpose flour, and then fry those things and, you know, just put them on a homemade bun with a nice thick slice of fresh summer tomato, a little bit of cheese, like a piece of Jack cheese, and some chopped up lettuce, man. There's nothing better than that. I love a fish sandwich.
I want to talk about dehydrated vegetables before we move on, though. I got to throw one out on the fish. If you ever just want to, folks, be a little bit indulgent with frying fish, take an egg dredge and dredge your fish, your fillets and egg, and roll it in good shredded Parmesan cheese. And then you got to fry that at like a lower temperature, like 300, 315, or it'll overdo it. But basically, you end up with this crusted egg batter with Parmesan. And, I mean, if you want low carb, that's as low carb as it gets. But it's not something I would eat every day. In fact, we do fried fish. A lot of times we'll do, like, good old-fashioned cornmeal batter, maybe some tempura batter, and this. And we do them all, you know, at the same time in different batches when we have a bunch of people over. But that's one I just wanted to throw out there. I don't know if you've ever done anything with frying with Parmesan on it, but I didn't believe it would work. And my good and late friend Hal Dodd, God rest his soul, showed me that one because he was big into the low-carb stuff. And I'm like, that can't possibly work. I figured the cheese would just melt away in the deep fryer, but it doesn't. The big thing with it is you, and I think a lot of people would have more success with their frying, roll, do your egg dredge, do your roll, put it on a plate, stick it in the refrigerator for about 15 minutes or 30 minutes or even longer before you fry it, and it seems like more of the batter stays on the fish if you do that.
No, that's a great point. Yeah, even battering it up and then putting in the freezer for 30 minutes before you fry it. But one thing to point out with the Parmesan cheese is, and bear with me, my little son has just come in. Hey, sweetheart.
No worries. He's welcome on the show, too.
Yeah. He's a survivalist. All right, just 1 second. You can't cry when I'm trying to have an interview. Sorry, Jack.
Don't worry about it. Take care of what you got to do. I'm an editing
program. He's okay. One thing with the Parmesan cheese to note is, if you buy the stuff in the green can, which I definitely don't recommend, what they're doing to that is they put, you'll read in there, it'll say anti-caking agent. And they use cellulose. And cellulose is basically, they get it from harvesting corn stalks and all types of starch. And the cellulose keeps it from caking. But if you use that and you fry with it, it burns.
Absolutely.
So if you're going to use Parmesan cheese, sorry, Jack, hold on.
No worries.
If you're going to use Parmesan cheese, grate it fresh or buy, you know, the real deal stuff that doesn't have the anti-caking agents in it. And then it is great. It's also awesome for, like, oven-baked chicken. You make a batter and you put Parmesan cheese in it, and then you do baked chicken. Ah, awesome, with some fresh herbs in there. Makes a great snack.
Absolutely. Cool, man. So you're getting at the end of an hour here. I did want to talk a little bit about dehydrated vegetables and using those with some cooking ideas as well before we wrapped up today, though, because, again, I've got so many people gardening now. I know from just feedback, we have tons of people that have gone out and bought, you know, Excalibur dehydrators or have built solar ones in their backyard. They're putting up large amounts of vegetables. And, again, that's great. But I get a lot of great results cooking with them, and I don't want people, just because they'll store forever, not using them. I mean, if you're growing food, you're doing all this work, you're putting it up, and then, you know, it's January, and it's hard to come by some fresh-cut peppers that are local and all, but you're not going to make a salad out of a dehydrated pepper and eat it raw. It just doesn't work out. A lot of stuff you can cook with it, though. You got some stuff for us on that?
Yeah, that's another great point. One thing, people that grow gardens, the one thing that's really helped Harvest Eating grow the site, and, you know, myself as a chef, is that people are always looking. They get panicked because they're not prepared. Gardeners, particularly new gardeners, they don't realize that when you plant a zucchini plant, for instance, or even a bell pepper, I mean, those things are going to put out tons and tons of vegetables. So a lot of people are scrambling, how am I going to use it? And they let them, number one, grow too big, but then number two, they just don't have any culinary inventory. And this is what
real
I'm trying
quick,
to teach people.
I got to say this real quick when you mentioned the zucchini. Sure. Growing up in Pennsylvania in August when the harvest was heavy from the zucchini, it was a small town. Nobody locked their cars, their house, or anything except in August. Because if you left your car unlocked or your house unlocked in August and you weren't home, somebody would show up with a bag of zucchini to give you and leave it there. And everybody had it in excess, and dehydration wasn't something we really practiced at the time. So you're dead on about that. So I'll let you go. I just wanted to tell everybody that because it's to drive home the point of how much a few zucchini bushes produce.
No, that's for sure, and it's one of my favorite crops. But if you're prepared ahead of time, let's say you're going to grow three or four vegetables that are good to be
you know, dried or canned. Just knowing what you're going to do with it ahead of time is key. But like you mentioned, a lot of people are drying vegetables, and they definitely need to be stored properly. After they're dried, I like to seal them up in cryovac and make sure they're dried, but then they're cryovac to keep the air off of them. But there's a lot of great things that you can make with those, and you got to understand that when you take, just like a dried mushroom, when you take all of the liquid out of a vegetable, it obviously becomes hard, but then when you rehydrate it, it doesn't go back to its sort of normal state. It'll still have a slight, sort of like a chewiness to it, which I find really awesome. Now, one thing I like to do with an assortment of dried vegetables is to rehydrate them and then use them on top of a pizza, like a homemade pizza with dehydrated vegetables that have been rehydrated, and then put them on a pizza with some melted cheese. They've got a much better texture. They've got that kind of chewy thing going on. Another thing that they're great for, and this is another what I would call a jump-off dish. You, when you start to get into harvest eating and you're starting to learn about seasonal cooking, a dish like risotto, which is a classic Italian peasant dish. I'm sure you've had it before. It's funny. You go into restaurants now and you pay $20 for a bowl of risotto. I'm sure the Italians are laughing their butts off because it's the cheapest. You know, it's just a grain. It's rice. It's a wide rice. It's grown in what they call the Po River Valley in Italy, and it's what sustained all the peasants. But it's a great dish for harvest eating because you can, once you learn how to make risotto, you can use all types of seasonal vegetables. And I definitely encourage, we've got recipes and videos up on the website, we'll provide links, but I encourage people to learn the basic recipe for risotto, because then you can use things like these dehydrated vegetables, and you can just rehydrate them right in the risotto pot. But you can use leeks, you can use asparagus, you can use mushrooms, butternut squash, kale. I mean, just about anything can go into risotto and make a really nice dish. But I love the dehydrated vegetables. And I'll have like zucchini, onions, bell peppers, mushrooms, things like that go really well in risotto. They're great in soups. You can take dehydrated vegetables. Remember we talked about making a nice chicken stock? You could do the same thing with beef bones and make a beef stock, but floating those dehydrated vegetables in a nice broth, like maybe with some egg noodles, is a great thing. Also, they make an awesome vegetable burrito. Take black beans and a bunch of rehydrated, you know, mixed vegetables, and once they're back, you know, to their rehydrated, they get a little plump, and they've got that chewy texture. They're awesome in a burrito, like with black beans and cheese. Really,
that's great because we got so many people storing legumes and different beans as part of their store. So now you've got your dehydrated vegetables, your dehydrated beans, something maybe we wouldn't normally see going together, and you could do a burrito with it. I guess if you store corn, dried corn, and you grind that, you made your own corn tortillas, you could do more of an enchilada-type recipe with it as well.
Right, and then another thing I like to make, again, another great seasonal sort of base recipe is what I call confetti rice. And it's basically long grain rice. It's cooked with a little bit of butter and salt, and then put in a bunch of, you know, rehydrate your vegetables. You don't want to put those in rice not rehydrated because it'll suck up too much of the water. But once you rehydrate those, just put some boiling water over them, drain it out, and then mince them up. You know, you can use carrots, bell peppers, zucchini, things like that, and then put them into rice. And instead of just having plain white rice, you've got rice that, number one, is cooked with a little butter, but then has all these colorful vegetables that came out of your garden. And you can make that year-round. That confetti rice is a great tweet. You know, we eat a lot of black beans and rice around the snow household, and you've got to make rice taste good. I mean, it's such an easy... And a lot of people store rice, too, but having a way to cook with it, again, increasing your culinary inventory, trying these things, that's what I encourage your people to do, is try these recipes now. Don't wait until you're forced to kind of cook on your own. Get into it. It's social. It's the best thing you can do for your own health is to learn how to make these dishes, these soups, these stocks, these rice dishes. All this kind of stuff is going to make you much healthier, going to make you a proficient cook, and you're going to be focused on the seasons, because that's what's critical. In my mind, should things get bad, I'm hoping they don't, but should they get bad, the term seasonal cooking is going to become front and center. And people that don't have this culinary inventory that I talk about, those are the ones that are going to have the roughest time. You need to learn how to cook with the fruits and vegetables and the game and the grains that are local to you, and you need to be prepared. You know, I know you're a big gardener, Jack, but you probably can foods. You probably dehydrate foods.
Absolutely.
So you got to plan ahead of time. That way, when you have a crop, you're going to have things to do with it. One of the things I'll kind of totally go off track here, but we're looking at a Jersey cow, and I went to see it just last Saturday. It's about a four-year-old Jersey cow that most likely we're going to buy and put it out here. But when I start to milk that cow, I'm going to know ahead of time how to make butter, which I know how to make, yogurt, which I know how to make, creme fraiche, cheese. So I'll have a way to use up these valuable resources. And, you know, you mentioned beef and grass-fed beef. The folks that have this cow, they also raise beef. And that's another thing for people. Think of the amount of resources that go into raising beef in a traditional way. These feedlots, all the trucking, the processing. It's a very unsustainable practice, and the meat really isn't any good. I mean, if you're honest with yourself,
no,
cows.
It's not. You go and you go to the nice, expensive supermarkets, and you see the beautiful red meat. That red color is not what that meat looks like. They've added coloring and blood back into the meat with agents to hold the blood in the meat. If you go to, like, your supermarket, you see that nice piece of steak, and you go down to where the manager has the specials, where they're clearing the meat out, where the meat's been there a week and they need to get rid of it, the color that meat looks like, that drained color, that's what the pretty one looked like, too, before it was treated. When you get real good quality meat, it looks like that. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to make it look like that. There's so much garbage. And I hate to put it that way, but there's so much garbage in our food supply. And I can't say that, you know, we're realists. So I can't say that we're 100% organic with all our meat use, but we try to get as much free range, grass fed, organic meat as our diet as we can. We hunt, we fish, we bring the garden in so that when we are eating the piece of chicken that came from the normal shelf, it's the exception rather than the rule. And we feel so much healthier. And so much better. And on your comments with the dried vegetables, one thing I want to throw out there is when you're cooking with them and you're putting in the soups and all, it's real logical that you just dump all the vegetables and the water they soaked in there. When you're doing something like a pizza, which I've never thought of, but or anything where you're reserving the water that the vegetables rehydrated in, and you're not, because you're not going to dump the excess water on top of a pizza, obviously, it's going to make it all watery, that juice that comes off of those vegetables, put it in a jar, put it in the refrigerator, use it the next time you cook. When you rehydrate vegetables next time, folks, especially if it's more than one, it's like some peppers and carrots and celery or whatever, taste the water after the vegetables have rehydrated it. The flavor that you have there, you don't want to throw that away. It's so valuable to cook with. And another one I'll throw out that I do all the time, I'll go and I get, you know, pull out my dehydrated vegetables and go, what do I feel like today? Some mushrooms, some celery, some pepper, some onion. Throw that in a little dish, rehydrate it with water, and then make an omelet with it. I mean, it's so simple, and I can actually eat peppers from my garden in February then. You know, and that's something that normally I wouldn't be able to do.
Yeah, that's a great point. And that's one thing that us chefs are taught to do is, you mentioned the liquid. You know, when you go, a lot of people will steam broccoli or, you know, cauliflower, whatever you do, that steaming water, or even if they boil it, that water has got a lot of nutrients in it. It's got a ton of flavor. Definitely reserve that to make soup with. And, you know, with dehydrated, I've got a line of pasta sauces called Thoughtful Harvest. One of them is a sun-dried tomato sauce. And we have these meaty sun-dried tomatoes, and when we rehydrate them, we never dump that liquid. All of that liquid goes right into the kettle, and that's why the sauce tastes so, I mean, it's like an explosion of tomato flavor because we don't dump the liquid. The liquid is key. And I wanted to jump back over to the beef, Jack, because you're making a lot of good points. And if you look at, like I said, the way that beef is produced being so unsustainable, And you talk about buying the beef in the store. One thing that the listeners could be aware of is if you go to the supermarket, there's going to be some beef in there that's prepackaged, and that's the beef that's branded, you know, and I'm not going to mention the names, but it comes in a little styrofoam pack, and it's got the plastic over it, and it's got a label, and it's a company. Those are definitely the ones to avoid, particularly in the big store. We know what the big store is that's all over the country. Don't buy the meat that's in their trays. Those styrofoam trays, that's the stuff where they use like a technology where it goes under pressure and they force that kind of red liquid in there to make it look red like that. Because if it doesn't, meat in a couple of days will start to go grayish brown, but they want it to look red, so they're definitely chemically enhancing it. But the way to avoid it is don't buy the stuff that's branded and packaged. Buy the meat that looks like it came from the back where they sliced it up and put it in a regular tray. But stay away from that, you know, plastic covered meat, because that's definitely the bad stuff.
The worst of the worst.
Yes, the worst of the worst. I got a couple steaks from this guy the other day, and we had a ribeye, and I broiled it. I put some of my steak seasoning on it, and I broiled it. Man, it was really good. And a lot of times people aren't used to, like, a grass-fed beef, something that's not locked in a feedlot and, you know, fed a ton of corn. It's not going to have the fat content. It's going to be leaner. And you don't want to overcook it. Like you said, you want to cook it lightly. Get a nice char on the crust, but then have it rare, and that's going to be a much healthier meat. And oftentimes it can be overcooked and dry, but I cooked this ribeye, and I broiled it hard. I mean, it was 2 or 3 inches from the elements in the oven, and it had a nice crispy sear on both sides, but it was nice and tender in the middle. And, you know, think about deer. I mean, a deer, as long as it's a healthy deer, that thing is eating its natural. They're browsers like goats, and they browse on all kinds of grasses and leaves and twigs. That's a healthy meat. It's not locked up in a feedlot and just jammed full of corn and other garbage. I mean, you wouldn't believe what they feed, what they put in those feedlots, those feeding operations. I met a trucker one time.
Unfortunately, I know what they put in there. Because I've seen it. And I mean, I don't think people realize this. Cattle come from Northern Europe. They all go back, all these different breeds of cattle that we're using for meat animals today. There's some that are out of the sub-Saharan Africa area and stuff like that. But most of what's become the cattle that we're growing today have their roots in the white ox of the European forest. The cattle are supposed to live in the forest. They're supposed to come out to the edge of the forest and browse the edges and live on acorns and things and everything out. And the cattle love this stuff. They basically they're the animal that spread the forest. They would keep eating away at the edges of it and then, you know, manuring it and fertilizing it, and they were actually the catalyst that spread nutrient and grew the forest. They're not meant to live on corn in a feedlot standing shoulder to shoulder. It's not a natural state for the animal in any conceivable fashion, and to think that they're going to produce the quality of meat for you that they would in a natural environment where they're free range is insane. It's like expecting to get water out of a mud puddle and have it taste like water out of a spring. It's just not going to happen.
No, that's exactly right. It's and people, you know, they don't want to hear it, and they don't want to kind of see what the truth is. But those animals, they were not raised. They're not designed or whatever. Some people believe in intelligent design, others in evolution. Whatever you believe in, you can say to yourself, a cow is not designed, like you said, to be jammed into a muddy feedlot and to be eating corn. It's just not what the animal is meant to do, and that produces a very acidic rumen. Cows are they're ruminants. They like to chew their cud, and when that rumen, when their stomach has too much acid in there, the animal is constantly in a state of sickness. That's definitely not what you want to do with a deer or an elk or buffalo, whatever it might be, even cow that's out on the grass and, like you said, along the edge of the forest eating some leaves and nuts and things like that. The meat is much healthier. There's a company called Caw Caw Creek, and it's C-A-W-C-A-W, Caw Caw Creek, And this is a guy named Emil DeFelice. He's in St. Matthews, South Carolina. I've interviewed him for my TV show. He raises pork. And your point is well taken. These pigs, they live in the forest. They can come out and get a little grass, but they're basically a forest animal. And I've been there to see these pigs, and they're unbelievable. I mean, they're scratching their bellies on the trees. They're eating grubs and worms and hickory nuts, things like that. And this guy's got this pork, and it is just, it's world-class stuff. And he ships it through the mail. You can buy, I think it comes in like 50-pound packages, but you can get all different cuts. But, again, you try some of this pork, and then you try some of that lifeless stuff that you get in the supermarket, and the difference is night and day. And I'll throw something out there. Again, being a realist, sure, I eat pork from the supermarket because I can't, buy this other stuff all the time. But when you are going to buy pork from the supermarket, a lot of people are buying pork tenderloins. Definitely don't buy the ones that are pre-marinated because they're just pumped up.
God knows what the hell's in there.
Yeah.
The cheapest crap, I know what's in there, the cheapest crap they can get, and they're probably full of sugar, too, because sugar and fat together are addictive, and that gets you to come back and buy more from, you know, whoever it is that packaged it up. It's pretty nasty, the state that we're in today, and I've always found this crazy. You got these hog farmers, and they're using antibiotics and immunizations and all this additives to the feed to get the pigs to grow fast and to be healthy, right? Because they don't want them sick and falling over and dying. And then we got ranchers in South Texas, and they would look at a farmer that says he has to do this to keep his hogs healthy like he's insane because they cannot eradicate them. They're running around out on these ranches in this harsh environment. They have nobody looking after them. They fight all the time, the boars do, and I've seen the boars pick up the piglets and throw them, and they've got these wounds all over them when you shoot them, these scars. They're perfectly healed. You can't kill them. They're absolutely bulletproof, but they're living in a natural state. And then we wonder why when we cram 80 of them together in one sty, and we keep them in an environment that they create for themselves in the wild, that they go to cool off or get insects off them, and we keep them in that environment all the time, you wonder why they're sick, why they spread diseases, why we have to keep pumping all this crap into them to keep them at a good growth rate, where out in the field, the sows are dropping 4 or 5 litters a year of 6 to 12 piglets, and I don't even understand why we farm pigs the way we do. It doesn't even make sense to me.
Yeah, coming from North Carolina, this is hog heaven here, and luckily I live in the western part of the state, but down east, along the Cape Fear River and all down there where there's a bunch of these hog farms, I mean, it's a pretty sad situation, not only for the pigs, but the people that live around those places, because it's the amount of waste and these lagoons filled with liquid manure, pretty horrible stuff. But you know what, let's switch up the talk here, because we're making people not hungry. Think about that chard and potato soup and a nice, how about some smoked trout pate and a glass of wine? Let's close like that, Jack.
Absolutely. Or let's go ahead and take that good organic or wild hog. Let's make some hot, nice, spicy sausage out of that, and let's add that to your chard and potato soup. And
there you go.
Tusk it with it. And I think that would just throw it absolutely, it goes from a side dish to the dish, and just throw it over the top. So, yeah, I do want to kind of wrap things up now. So, as we're wrapping up here today, I know, Keith, you always kind of like want to leave stuff behind for the audience. You come up maybe a special on a sauce or a seasoning, and you usually give a discount on something or another, or tell people to get your book. You gave out all these recipes. You kind of have a way you want to do that to make it easy for everybody this time?
Yeah, why don't I do this, Jack? I'm going to take all of these recipes, because they're kind of all over the board, and rather than have people, you know, search and try to find them, I'm going to put together a Word document that has all of the key recipes that we spoke about, and then they can just, you can put it up on your site or whatever, and then they can just download it, and they'll have all those recipes in one document.
That's all.
And then I definitely want to mention to the listeners that I put together some great specials. If you click on the ad, because I'm now one of your sponsors, if you click on the ad on the TSP homepage, you'll see Harvest Eating there. We've got some pretty steep discounts for the memberships there. Some of them have like even $50 a year off, so they're pretty good deals. And also we'll make available this Word document, that way they can try out all these recipes.
great. And I'll put a link to that document and a link to your site and all some other stuff you've got on there. I definitely highly recommend your book. You've got an awesome book that's available. They can buy it on your site. They can buy it from Amazon. If they buy it on your site, you ship it directly. Do you do anything with autographs or anything like that? Or
yeah, if they want to order it off of Harvest Eating, and I'll have a link on there. If you click from the ad from the TSP over to my site, there'll be a link for the book. But I'll definitely personalize it and autograph it and ship it directly to people that buy it. But, yeah, the book is really great. I mean, it's my own book, and, you know, obviously I wrote it, and I see it all the time. But the emails that come in from people that have that book, they just love the book. It's a really great book. It's a big book. It's like 300 pages. So it's kind of like the seasonal cooking Bible, if you will. So I definitely, I think people will be thrilled with the book. But we'll sign those and ship them direct.
And I want to throw a plug in for your spices, your pre-mixed spices. I ordered, I think, two, and you doubled it for me because we're taking care of each other here, entrepreneurs. And I got four sets of them, and I gave away two, and I kept two. And you mentioned your Montreal steak seasoning, and that is probably one of the best steak seasonings I've ever used in my life. I just had a listener stop by the house, and I made up some grass-fed ribeyes we did on the grill that I coated on both sides with that Montreal steak seasoning. That is absolutely phenomenal. The Herb de Provence stuff is really awesome, too. Actually, all of it's good, but those are the two that I've kind of played around with the most. And I don't know, man. When I tried the Montreal steak seasoning, I was like, that's Montreal steak seasoning, but I almost know if you could call it something else, because when people hear that, they think of the little thing from McCormick that comes in a jar or something like that. And
yeah,
there's a relationship there, I guess, because there's some of the same ingredients, but it's a very divorced relationship. It's so much more fresh, and the peppers and the salt, they come through on the meat, and it, you know, I get the grill like lightning hot and sear the steak, and it just goes into this caramelized black crispy, and you said make people hungry at the end. I'm doing my best here, and making myself hungry, probably eating steak tonight now. I need to go take something out of the freezer.
They're great. They're awesome herb and spice mixes, and the key thing about them is they're also 100% organic, and they don't have fillers in them. A lot of these companies that, I won't mention the name that you just did, but they put in a lot of fillers in there.
Starch.
And because, yeah, starches and anti-caking agents and
a lot of sodium glutamate and other crap.
Yeah, too much salt, MSG. These are pure seasonings. And like you mentioned, there's seeds in there and whole spices, and you'll find cumin seeds. It's just really incredible stuff. I wanted to mention, we do, with our membership on the website, if anybody decides they want, you know, complete access, we've got a couple of plans, and two of the plans, not only do you get access to the website, but we mail you a box of goodies. And we've got an annual plan where you get some of the Thoughtful Harvest pasta sauce, and I think you get three full-size bags of the spices and the membership. And then we also do a lifetime membership, Jack, and with that, you get lifetime access to the site, and you also get a signed Harvest Eating cookbook, four jars of Thoughtful Harvest pasta sauce, and six full-size bags of the spices. And we just really put that up, and your listeners get a $50 discount on that, and that's been really popular. So that's kind of a great way to experience the whole thing. But, yeah, those spices are killer. As a matter of fact, when I go back in the house, I'm standing on the front porch right now, my mom has got a pot of split pea soup on the stove, and she's got some of my northern Italian spices in there, and it's got oregano and basil and a little bit of dried porcini mushroom. Oh, it smells great.
Now you're making me want to cook split pea. I'm gonna cook something as soon as I get off the air with you here today. We are going to wrap up now, folks. Chef Keith, I'm going to bring you back on. I've got some other stuff I want to talk about in the future. I'm not going to let you go into it now because we'll go for another 20 minutes and we'll be way, way over time. But, like, I want to have you come back on and talk about I'm growing fava beans right now through the winter and a lot of other cool stuff. So maybe we'll look at next month bringing you back on using things like chives in your winter cooking and onions and stuff like that. I know you've got stuff for that. I appreciate you being here today. And, folks, definitely Chef Keith is one of the good guys. Check out his site. Check out his membership options.
Check out his recipes. It's not going to steer you wrong. And he's a big advocate for the seasonal eating, for good quality food, and all this thing, avoiding the GMOs, all the stuff we talk about. Keith, thanks for being here with us today.
Hey, Jack, I appreciate you having me on. I look forward to chatting with you again. And I want to thank everybody for listening and just wish everyone well.
Okay, folks, with that, we will wrap up now. This has been Jack Spirico today, along with Chef Keith Stowe, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. The revolution is you.
Seeing our food these days, you know it's on our TVs. Sometimes we forget. Are what we eat. I don't know the answer. It's like there's nothing I can do. It's the price we pay, I guess, when we follow all the rules. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. Nobody up there cares.